Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the New Books Network in British Studies. I'm Tyler Yank, a co-host of the channel, and today I have the pleasure to speak to Dr. Robert Ingram. Dr. Ingram is a professor in the History Department of Ohio University and the director of the George Washington Forum on American Ideas, Politics, and History. Today, he is here with me to discuss his brand new book, Reformation Without End, Religion, Politics, and the Past in Post-Revolutionary England, which was just published in 2018 by Manchester University Press. Robert, thank you very much for joining me today, and welcome to the show.
Yeah, long time listener, first time caller. Thanks for having me.
Robert, I wonder if you could begin by saying a little bit about yourself and some of the projects you've been involved in over the past little while.
Yeah, thanks. We were talking offline. I'm sort of from the deep south, and your parents say never say nice things about yourself. But I'll try to maybe help set the, scene a little bit, at least for the book. So I teach at Ohio University, but I'm not from Ohio. And as I was sort of thinking about this, the kind of slightly weird background that I had, may explain, at least my interest in the book. So I grew up in Louisiana. Family's all from there. It's people who know anything about the state. It's kind of like a poor man's Ireland. The south part of the state is predominantly Roman Catholic, and the north part is predominantly Protestant. And I grew up in the north part and was a Presbyterian. And it made me think, well, religion, it really matters, right? It matters for your identity. It matters knowing what somebody's religious past is, or where they stand on first principles, sort of it's just a really important thing to help you understand that person. So, I grew up, pine trees and Protestants in North Louisiana. And I thought, like all kids did, that was all there was. And then I went undergrad. I went to a place called the University of the South in Suwanee, Tennessee. And Suwanee is owned by or run by the Episcopal Church of the 28 or something like that, Southern Diocese in the U.S. And the chapel is right in the middle of campus. It's modeled on, I think, St. Mary the Virgin, the university chapel at Oxford. And some of the buildings are modeled on different Oxbridge buildings in the kind of way that you did in the South in the 19th century, sandstone and Gothic architecture on top of a mountain. But the chapel's right there. And you go in and on a Sunday, and there was a lot of kneeling and standing, and it was confusing, and smells and bells. And it seemed, to my Protestant eyes and ears, nose, kind of a Catholic-y like place, but it was Protestant. So yeah, sort of became familiar with the Anglican tradition there. And I went to grad school. I went to the University of Virginia and UVA. I was a nun. I was, if you slept in on Sundays, that's what I did. Wasn't much organized religion at all. Got my PhD there. And then my first only job, was at Ohio University. And we came here 15 years ago. And while here, for, you know, a variety of reasons, surprising to me, swam the Tiber and became Roman Catholic. So I sort of grew up Presbyterian, went to an Episcopal college, didn't do much of anything in my 20s. And then, you know, am a papist of a sort now. And so that, you know, I like to think it allows me to look at, to look at the past religious affiliations, religious beliefs from at least sympathetically from a variety of perspectives. And it certainly, you know, led me to take religion seriously. Maybe the second thing is, again, you know, just idiosyncratically, the particular grad school training I had, my advisor died halfway through. So I sort of, you know, was kind of a bit of an orphan and picked up. But it meant that, I mean, bad for him. The good thing was it just meant that I wasn't, I wasn't trained up in one particular school or methodological approach. So it's sort of an old fashioned, you know, English empiricist, ask a question, go look at the evidence, see what happens. And, if there is an approach, it's just, you know, that old Quentin Skinner line, you know, try to see things their way. And the kinds of historians that I've liked and the kinds of book that I'm trying to write, is one that, is trying to see the 18th century their way. And in a, write a book that people about whom I'm writing would recognize, but also it means that I'm not completely beholden to modern categories, right? For thinking about the 18th century. Mm-hmm. I hope that's the value added. Maybe it's not, but I like to think that if there's value added, that's where it comes from.
Great. So then in terms of setting the scene, your book examines life in a post-revolutionary society. So for example, you write that the 18th century English were a revolution-haunted people. So set the scene for us. What does that mean?
So if you go ask historians, right, of Britain, and you know this, right, you're a British historian, I'll say, well, how do you chop up the British past? And I'll say, well, you know, there are colleagues in the department who work in early modern Britain. And where does early modern Britain end? Well, it ends, I don't know, maybe it ends around the Restoration, maybe in 1660, maybe it ends in the Glorious Revolution of 1668, 69. And then where does modern history begin? It's after that. So there's the sort of arc is there's a Reformation in the 16th century. It sort of, you know, extends into the 17th century. There's civil wars in the 1640s. There's an interregnum. There's a restoration of the monarchy in 1660, and in 1688-89 there's a Glorious Revolution, and all of that stuff from the past, you can almost draw a line under it. The image I use in my book is like a continental divide, right? So the all the historiographical waters from 1689, maybe 1714 back, they flow back into this sort of sea of early modernity. And after 1688, we're into modern Britain, and there are different kinds of problems. Religion doesn't matter much. It's a secular society. It's a polite and commercial people. Empire matters, political economy, the kinds of modern kinds of questions are important. And this book, if there's one thing it does, it asks, well, did all the problems unleashed by the Reformation, did they actually go away with 1688-89? Can you have a Glorious Revolution and all of a sudden it just doesn't matter, right? And the argument is, yeah, it does matter, right? All of these problems unleashed by the Reformation had a life in the 18th century, and they were important for politics and intellectual life. And you can't understand that thing we call the English Enlightenment, and you can't understand English politics. You can't understand 18th century England unless you understand that the people living in it were haunted by the worst, the bloodiest war in English history, the English Revolution. And it was a huge loss of life in that revolution. And so they didn't forget it, right? We have. And so it's trying to sort of ask, what was it like to live in a world haunted by the revolution? It's about forgetting. It's about managing it. It's about trying to deal with the same problems that caused the English Civil Wars and the Glorious Revolution, these problems unleashed by the Reformation. What sort of state is the English state? What sort of church should the English church be? What should the relation between English church and state believe? What should the English church believe? How should people who go to the English church worship? All of these problems weren't necessarily solved by the Glorious Revolution. There was a temporary solution, but intellectually the issues remained live. And so what the book is trying to do is to think about how do the things we think of as early modern problems, how did they play in what we think of, I would say, erroneously, as modern Britain. So that's why I call it Reformation Without End. It's about a reformation that contemporaries thought just couldn't end. And they worried about a recurrence of the sort of bloody wars of the 17th century.
Great. And then just, I guess, for someone like myself with a little bit less knowledge of the Reformation period and what came after, could you also say something about the nature of religious culture in this period? So how religious belief and practice tended to permeate, I think, many aspects of one's life?
Yeah, it's a great question. Now, a way that I sort of came into this, and maybe I'll just tell you, like how I actually came onto this book. I did not set out to write this book. I did not set out to research. I thought I was going to do something completely different. And I came across a complaint from David Hume in the late 1740s and early 1750s. And he's writing to his book publisher about his inquiry concerning human understanding. And he's making what I take to be a standard author's complaint. He's saying, "Hey, Andrew Miller, no one's reading my book. They're not paying any attention to this, and they're especially not paying to the stuff that I write about miracles. I've taken down miracles, and no one's paying attention to it. Instead, they're reading the book of this Cambridge librarian named Conyers Middleton." And I thought, when I just did a throwaway line when I was working on my first book, I thought, "Oh, this is interesting, right? This guy is just." Nobody's writing his book, and he's upset about it, and he's trying to blame somebody. Surely he can't be right. And then I just sort of grabbed a string one summer. Somebody had told me, I like to think it's my advisor, but I can't remember exactly who said, when you go into an archive to do research, always look at manuscript material that has nothing to do with the project you're currently working on, right? It'll help you see your project differently, and it'll give you ideas for the future. So I was in the British Library, and I pulled up Middleton's letters and started reading them. I thought, well, this guy's an interesting guy. I wonder how many people were reading Middleton. And once I started counting, I realized that Hume was right. Most people who responded who got engaged in a debate about miracles in the 1740s and 50s were in fact responding to Conyers Middleton. I thought, okay, well, I didn't know that. What else don't I know? And I just started digging in archives, but also counting. And one of the things that's interesting about the 18th century is if you just start looking at what books sold, somewhere most liberally understood, somewhere a little over a half of books were related in some way or another to religion, and most narrowly conceived, around a quarter. So somewhere, if you want to take the most cramped definition, around a quarter of everything published was related to religion, and at its most expansive, somewhere around 50 to 60%. And then you think, well, booksellers they're not public charities, right? People that they have to sell. So if it's printing, it's selling. Okay, good. Well, right. So then you have, there are a lot of things in a world exploding with print in the 18th century that deal with one aspect or another of religion, thinking about empire and religion, thinking about history and religion, thinking about natural science and religion. And so then I thought, well, what were they talking about? What sorts of things were they talking about? And one of the things that I hope comes through in the book is that if you're interested in empire, if you're interested in history, if you're interested in natural philosophy, if you're interested in almost any subject that you think is of modern historical importance, it's somebody in the 18th century was thinking about that. And indeed, probably most people in the 18th century were writing about that in theological terms. So I think the first thing to say about your question is, we think of the Reformation as being a religious moment, and that maybe the 18th, the 17th century civil wars were wars of religion. I think what I'd like to suggest is that 18th century England was an overwhelmingly Protestant place. It was an overwhelmingly Protestant culture. It was an overwhelmingly anti-Catholic or anti-papist culture as well. And that the arguments that had traction were ones that had to deal with theology, ecclesiastical history, in ways that are unexpected for us.
Yeah. And as you say, so the growth of print culture in the 17th and 18th centuries is extremely central to the book. So could you say a word about why this is significant?
Why print culture is? Yeah. Yeah. It's an attempt. One of the things about the book is I try to think about everything that is published, everything that's published as a work of polemic. And by that, I don't mean it in a pejorative way. I mean it as polemic as something that is trying to convince the reader to adopt a certain position or to do a certain thing. So a biblical commentary is a work of polemic. Something we think of as a normal political pamphlet is a work of polemic. So if you look at, you know, the four people who I center the book around and all the minor characters in the book, they're all making arguments to a growing reading public, trying to convince them to adopt one position or another. And so the way I think about the 18th century is it's a world awash in print, but it's a world awash in competing ideas about ecclesiology, about church-state relations, about what is true, in precisely the same way that the 17th and the 16th century was awash in print about what is true, what is the right ecclesiology, what is what kind of church should the Church of England be as well. So the print culture is about how do you make an argument that is plausible, that is going to convince people to adopt your position. And print doesn't change everything, but it changes a lot, right? Pulpit is a place where people make arguments. And there's some, you know, there's part of the book where I try to look at manuscript sermons to see how, you know, one of the characters, Zachary Gray, how the things that he says to a little Bedfordshire parish or a little Cambridge parish relate to some of the things that he says that he actually writes about in print. But the thing that's important to me about print in the 18th century is that it's the main way that you can mobilize people to your point of view. And so we need to think about the religious literature of the period as attempts to persuade, to cement people to your point of view, but also to persuade people as well.
Yeah, and you use the word phrasing polemical divines to describe each of the four characters. So what's a polemical divine?
So I'm not sure if it's the most elegant term I could have used, but they are clergy who engage in printed polemic. It was the shortest thing I could come up with. And part of the thing about using polemical divine is it's intentionally trying to get two meanings of that. One, I mean, as you'll see, I mean, these were the sort of public fights that these people engaged in were really vicious. I mean, they were really nasty at times. So I wanted to get it by using polemic. I wanted to get a sense of, our modern understanding of polemic as something that's got an edge to it and a kind of dark and maybe nasty side, but also they're trying to convince. Right. And so I wanted to get that across as well. So if you look, what are the things being printed in this print culture that's awash with religious print? It's clergy are doing a lot of it. Sometimes they're lawyers, sometimes they're people who aren't, but right at the heart of it are clerics of one sort or another who are engaged in trying to convince people to adopt their point of view.
Yeah. So in the meat of the book, you orient around four gentlemen, Daniel Waterland, Conyers Middleton, Zachary Gray, and William Warburton. So Who were each of these men, and why did you select them?
I thought that they're great myths. You should, like, when you talk to people who write second books, you should ask the question, how long do you think it would take you to research and write your second book? And my guess is that almost every author would say, oh, I thought it'd be really quick, right? The myth of the second book is pervasive in our profession. And I bought into it. I thought, oh, I'll write a short book. I found this Middleton stuff. There wasn't a long study on Middleton. I thought this would be great and it'd be fine. And I realized somehow a biography wasn't going to work. It just wouldn't do full justice to, it wouldn't do full justice to the material. Cause I was reading Middleton, who was Conyers Middleton was, a Cambridge Don. He came from York in the North, but came to Cambridge and never left. And he ended up becoming a fellow of Trinity College, Cambridge, and then he ended up becoming a librarian, great battler of Richard Bentley, one of the great classicists. And I thought the book would be about him. But then as I started to read, I realized, well, you know, it's hard to tell that story without telling the story of his contemporary, Daniel Waterland, who wasn't from York, but was from Lincolnshire and came to Magdalen College, Cambridge, and never left. And then I realized, well, you know, there's this other character, Zachary Gray, somebody else from also from York, who came to Cambridge and never, there's a theme here, came to Cambridge and never left, and was somebody. And then I realized, well, you couldn't tell it without somebody else who actually didn't go to Cambridge, the one non-college educated person of this, but who was a cleric, who had been a lawyer himself, William Warburton, who John Pocock says is one of the two great figures of the English Enlightenment, Edward Gibbon being the other one. So I was trying to figure out, how am I going to make, these people are fighting with each other. And I thought, well, this would be a great way to sort of look at four people who are contending with one another, bring in all of the sort of side characters, and this would give me a way to capture really the full range of what's going on. So I wouldn't be writing about deism or about natural philosophy or about ecclesiology. I'd be able to see the whole range of interests of these authors. But I had, I must say, I had no way to figure out how to organize it. And I finally figured it out. It may be completely loopy, but I was rereading William Faulkner's Sound and the Fury, which is why there's an epigraph at the beginning from Faulkner. And I thought, this is it, right? So I'll tell the same story basically from four different points of view. So if you know that novel, it's a novel in which Faulkner tells the same story roughly from four different points of view. So I thought, I'll just do that and I'll try to weave bits and pieces, trying to be slightly artistic. But what I was trying to do by talking about Waterland, the kind of apotheosis, as I call him, of orthodoxy, and Middleton, somebody who was a contemporary of Waterland's, but reached very different conclusions, and Gray and Warburton, was trying to give a sense of just the full range of interests of English intellectual life more generally, but also of polemical divines in the 18th century.
Yeah. So these four men, they were in conversation with each other.
Yes.
Okay. And did it get heated?
Yeah. Short answer. Yes, it did. It did get heated. I think one of the, if looking at, the big themes that, the sort of subjects that I'm, talking about in the book, the Eucharist and Christology and deism and the primitive church and how is one saved and Methodism and miracles, and you think about this thing, well, it's not actually like who's going to get huffed, about this. As it turns out, everyone who engaged in this debate got angry about it. One of the things that I found that was interesting about Middleton and that really drew me to him is that he's the perfect example. There's the clearest evidentiary example of precisely how someone could make an argument, and Middleton's argument that Hume disapproved of, or that Hume thought people were paying attention to, was Middleton said, unlike Hume, I believe that there that miracles are possible. And I believe that there were some miracles, and those miracles happened only during the life of Christ. And after that, there were no miracles. So on the one hand, Middleton's saying, yes, I think the miraculous is possible, and I believe that God became incarnate, and I believe that he died, and I believe that 3 days later he arose and ascended into heaven, etc. On the other hand, I believe that there were no other miracles that happened, after that. And you'd think, well, that's a pretty conservative position to take. In the 18th century, people thought that was a wildly radical position to take, right? Because the debate was, well, when did miracles actually end? Great. So that's the issue at play. What you find is that Robert Walpole, the first prime minister of Great Britain, it went as high as him involved in which people tried to screw over Conyers Middleton's career and did it successfully. And so part of what I try to trace in the book is precisely how he fell out. I mean, he was sort of a hail fellow well met. He was liked by his contemporaries until he wasn't liked by his contemporaries. And the thing that made him not liked by his contemporaries was precisely the fact that he argued some things that they thought were heterodox. So to be able to chart how the sort of personal effect of what it meant to be heterodox, but not to be a kind of free thinker or a deist, but just to be a kind of slightly heterodox Christian, right? I mean, that was considered to be radical. And what you see is that one, the efforts to suppress his career, because he was clearly a very clever person who should, by all rights, have been on the Episcopal bench, sat in the House of Lords. It was short-circuited, and it was short-circuited by very powerful people. But what you also see is the way that actually radicalized Middleton and made him take on positions that he might not have taken on early. In other words, his anger, seeps through, but also you see his position becoming slightly more radicalized and hardened as he moves through. And he himself, as you saw in the book, says, I'm just sick of it. It's like, it's like Michael Douglas in Falling Down. It's somebody who gets angrier and angrier and angrier. And in the end, he doesn't take a gun and start walking the LA freeways, but he does start firing at any friend or former friend possible to sort of try to exact some sort of public, some public revenge. So trying to give you a sense of how this worked, but also to show the mechanisms of it. And one of the things that's sort of interesting about Middleton is, I tried to show earlier in the book, one of the things that's interesting is how many books were published anonymously. All right, so Matthew Tindall, one of the characters that I have in this book, wrote famously Rites of the Christian Church in the early 1700s and wrote Christianity as Old as Creation, never put his name to a book. Any book that he wrote from the 1690s to the 1730s. And if you start looking, on ESTC or Ebo or Echo and start asking who wrote what, you'll often see names in brackets, right? This pamphlet is attributed to someone, but his name isn't, or her name isn't on the title page. And one of the reasons that is that it prevents you from being persecuted. And it might actually at times prevent you from being prosecuted. So the fear of being prosecuted by the law for saying something libelous or treasonous, and also the position of being persecuted. So Middleton was persecuted, but Middleton was also perfectly willing to prosecute, to use the law to prosecute, some of his polemical opponents, Richard Bentley in the late 1710s and early 1720s, being an example of that. So yeah, long answer. It got very contentious and feelings were hurt. And when you read this stuff, you think, oh, these are all clergymen and they're just dripping with acid, right? You realize somebody like Swift or Defoe are normal, not not weird, right? I mean, these are anomalous figures. They write like everybody else. They just write more elegantly, right, than everybody else in their period. Nasty, nasty period.
Yeah, and
reminds us of our own, right, in some ways, right? You know,
yeah.
You don't need Twitter. It's not 140 characters to do it. It's just a 14 or 20 page pamphlet in which you can fire off your missive at your political opponent.
That's a great comparison. And another sort of central idiom, I guess, within these 18th century debates was actually history, which I found kind of interesting. So like the history of Christianity and the history of the church, and these four gentlemen were sort of writing about this. So could you say a little bit about that and sort of where it and the research of history fits in?
Yeah, so I think, you know, if you asked any, undergrad or grad student, you're like, what was the 18th century? That's the age of enlightenment. What's the age of enlightenment? The age of enlightenment is the time when reason, reason, which the standard of evidence was reason. As it turns out, that's just not really the case, right? You know, rationalist metaphysics weren't the thing. The mode of argument, the mode, whether, you know, whatever position you took, the most heterodox or the most orthodox, it depended on how well you did, what kind of history you wrote. And so polemics were about telling plausible narratives about the past. And as you sort of rightly note, what kinds of pasts? The ancient church, right? Ancient Rome, ancient church, ancient Christian church, but also the English Reformation, the English Civil Wars. And then, one of the things that mattered in that was your sources, right? So one of the things that becomes evident through this is that there are people who hoard certain sources, right? So Zachary Gray has access to the papers, a certain set of 17th century original manuscripts, the Knowlson manuscripts. Only Orthodox people are let to look at those manuscripts. Then there are the Morris papers, and only sort of heterodox types are allowed to look at the Morris papers. So you see polemical sides, in a sense, guarding sources. So we think, yeah, you go to the British Library, you go to the National Archives, you go to some archive, anybody can look at it and make your own judgment. People are hoarding, as it were, archives in the 18th century, and only letting the right sorts of people take a gander at them, and not letting the wrong sorts of people take a gander. So even archives are, in a way, polemicized, made polemical in the 18th century. But then, one of the things that I didn't expect to find, right? There's a lot of stuff I didn't expect to find in this. But one of the things I didn't expect to find were that even sometimes when I was reading people like, William Warburton's Alliance of Church and State, I mean, there were others as well, is that they were thinking about these subjects by reading history. So you'd read the book itself. And the example I give in the book is the Alliance of Church and State. It's a kind of Lockean take, Erastian reading on how the English church and state should relate to one another, right? So there it is. There's almost nothing about English history in that. It's written in the early 1730s, published in 1736. One of the things that you realize, though, is that he wrote that book while reading Clarendon's History of the English Rebellion. And I found in the Hurd Library in Hartlebury, Warburton's own copy of it. And you say, oh, he's reading this in 1731 and 1732. And you can follow through the marginalia of everything that he wrote through the margins. And what's clear from that is that Warburton is absolutely freaked out about the possibility of a return to the world that Clarendon's writing about, the 1640s and the 1650s, a world of civil war. And the thing that he sees that caused that war was debates over religion. And so having an Erastian relationship of church and state was for him a solution to that problem. But none of that appears in the Alliance. We just know from marginalia that he's reading Clarendon's history while thinking about this problem of ecclesiology and of church-state relations. So everybody, every single chapter of the book is about how people thought about history. You know, I talk about how are Methodists understood, right? Methodists were understood as one of two or both things. One, they were just like those crazy Donatists in the early church, right? These people who were these persecutory, zeal-filled, enthusiastic crazies from North Africa in the early church. And or they were like those crazy Puritans from the 17th century. And so, and history was the way that people thought about Methodism or Newtonianism or natural philosophy or whatever it might be. History was the way that people tried to make sense of the present that they lived in the 18th century. So I sort of say people were using the past to help them make sense of the present, to orientate themselves toward the future.
Yeah. And I think that's something we should still be doing today. For example, history is the way.
Yes. Right. And some of there are good and bad ways to do that history. Right. And so you see, I think one of the other things so you've pointed a continuity with the present. I think maybe one thing to point a sort of disjuncture with the present is that each of the people in this book and the sort of minor characters, they all thought that the truth, that capital T truth, lay someplace in the past. And so they were sort of like, they were hunting for it in the past. Did it lie in the primitive church in the first 100 years of the church? Did it lie in the first 400 years? Did it lie in the first 800 years? Did it lie in the first 50 years of the Reformation or 100 years of the Reformation? Where did it lie? And so what gave these debates such vehemence, to go back to your previous, right point about the kind of temperature, is these people thought they were fighting about truth. They thought they were fighting about what was capital T true, right? So this wasn't just people being jerks to be jerks. They believed everything was at stake. The salvations of souls were at stake, their own and those of their countrymen and women, but also the fate of their nation. And so when you think you're in that kind of fight, it gives a kind of purchase to it that we often, I think today, sometimes miss when thinking about the past. Your point about bringing in the present, truth in advertising, right? I mean, one of the things that helped me, or that made me interested in this, once I grabbed a hold of an unexpected archival thread, was I was thinking about the present in which we live. To what degree can you think a heterodox thought? How can you express a heterodox thought? What are the consequences of saying a heterodox thought? What's rude? What's polite? What is true? What is not? What are the arenas in which one can argue that? My enjoinder to readers is in a way to think about the past and the way you said, like, it's instructive, right? I mean, there's nothing new under the sun. And we think we live in a world that's completely different from before. And sure, the issues that we face are in some ways, but in some ways they're not, right? We are concerned about what is true. How best should we argue for what we think to be true? How do we treat people who might disagree with us? And the 18th century world I write about, these sort of fusty clerics, has, to my mind at least, a hell of a lot to tell us about how we might think about it today.
All very important questions. Great. It's a great read. I'd like to wrap up our conversation by asking the traditional final last question with New Book Network podcasts. So what are you working on next?
Yeah. So, my first book was on the 1760s. My second book was on the 50s and 60s. My second book was on like the 20s, 30s and 40s. And my next is going to be on the 1690s. I'm sort of moving backward in time, foolishly. But also because, when you have to devote a lot of your own quiet time to sitting in archives and reading stuff. And my thought is, I've only got one life. I'd like to discover, in a sense, a different world every time. So I'm taking a theme that I sort of talk about at the end of the book, and that runs through this. You know, one of the things I say is that, you know, in the end, Leviathan won, and what I mean about that is the 18th century world is a debate about what constitutes, or intellectual world is a debate about what constitutes truth. Guess what? It wasn't solved then or now. What is metaphysically true? But contemporaries thought that in order to keep the peace, right, you need an arbiter. Who became the arbiter in the 18th century? The state became the arbiter, and you know, try to show a little bit of that in the book. So the next project that I'm working on is trying to think about how people of all stripes in the 18th century sacralized the state, that the state became the highest judge and arbiter. And I'm thinking about that, trying to think about it by way of thinking about Ireland and England in conjunction with one another, from the Glorious Revolution, basically, until the end of Walpole's reign, and choosing Ireland because it is about 90% of people are Roman Catholic and about 10% of people are Protestant, and thinking about England by way of comparison because about 99% of people are Protestant and a very, you know, less than 1% are Catholic, but both have an established church that is an Episcopal church. The Church of Ireland and the Church of England are the established churches in each of those countries, in Ireland and in England. And so trying to think both practically and intellectually about how people of all stripes, politicians and clerics and what we might think of as sort of public intellectuals, how they tried to go about justifying and affecting the sacralization of the state. So the state legitimately can become the final arbiter of truth. That's why I jokingly call it Hobbes's century, right? The 18th century were people who talked like Lockeans and acted like Hobbists. So we'll see if I can pull it off, but that at least is what I have my eye on next.
Great, Robert. Thank you so much. I want to thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it. So thank you again.
Thanks very much for having me. Appreciate it, Tyler.